from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Sometimes we, in the debates about the Declaration and the broader debate about America, we might conclude that, well, Jefferson wrote it, Jefferson read Locke, therefore it's Locke. Well, there's some Lockean influence there. There's some important Lockean influences there. But there's some other influences there as well. And so I think it's very important to really kind of understand it in this broader context.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Dr. Matthew Spaulding, our first guest on today's program. Dr. Spaulding is Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. We talked at length with Dr. Spaulding about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Scott.
And thanks for hosting me today as I visit in Washington at the Kirby Center, the Boyle Radio Studio here, a magnificent layout. It's always a pleasure to be here in Washington and to talk. We've talked previously on the program about the Declaration of Independence. I wanted to spend some time today speaking specifically about Thomas Jefferson and his contributions, large as they are, to the Declaration. When we think of the Declaration of Independence, we know Congress appointed a committee. So how did the Declaration chiefly then become the work of one Thomas Jefferson?
That's actually a great question. The history leading up to this moment, I think, if I can make it just one step backwards, is very important. If you recall what gives rise to the American Revolution or all these various things the British are doing after the end of the French Indian War, so that decade preceding it, they're raising taxes. They start enforcing their laws. They eventually are housing troops. So this has been building up. The colonies start agitating, and they eventually call a Continental Congress. There are two Continental Congresses, the first in 1774-75, and then the second comes back again in 1775-1776. And from the beginning, there's a divide and a debate. One of the things we want to study when we study this is this really this debate. How do we reconcile with the British and others who early on? Well, how do we start an independent nation? It gets to a point, especially after you get the outbreak of hostilities in April 1775, Lexington and Concord. If you recall, the British send troops out from Boston to find these rebel rousers who are supposedly collecting weapons. It gets to a point where we're going to need to kind of take the ultimate position, which is to declare independence. That crucial moment becomes when Virginia, in June of 1776, we've now kind of been developing almost for a year now after Lexington Concord. This is just getting worse and worse. They've appealed, make their final appeals, and finally Richard Henry Lee of Virginia moves, introduces his motion for independence. Well, at that point, they really knew that's where things were going to go. That motion triggered a number of things. One was to write a Declaration of Independence, which we'll come back to. Another was to begin thinking about what a constitutional government might look like. This doesn't take off until a number of years later, eventually becomes the Articles of Confederation, which was kind of started out at the same time. And the third thing that motion calls for is developing a relationship with a foreign nation, which becomes our alliance with France. So they're doing the things one would have to do to get ready for independence, and among those, they create a committee to write a declaration. That committee is made up of John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, the three most famous, but also Roger Sherman of Connecticut and Robert Livingston of New York. Committee of five. Committees hardly ever work. the short story, and if you've ever seen the there's a great musical that came out in the 1970s called, I believe it was called 1776. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty good. It's kind of just a 1970s for it. But the short story is that Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson kind of took the lead. Franklin at this point is an older, eminent Greece. He's not really involved. Adams had proven himself to be a great writer, as John Thomas Jefferson had. They've both written a lot of pamphlets. But John Adams annoys people. He's gruff. And he has been twisting arms to get this Declaration of Independence. He knows this, and in a great act of statesmanship, John Adams writes Jefferson and tells him to write it, because I annoy people, and you're from Virginia, and Virginia must take the lead on this. And so he tells Jefferson to write it, and that's what causes him to be the main author.
So if Adams is perceived, and rightfully so, it appears to be a pain in the behind to many, what's the general perception of Jefferson at this time?
I would add, Adams is a pain, but because he's a pain, his nickname actually is the Atlas of Independence, which is to say that he's the one that legislatively accomplished independence. He's the guy that got the legislation passed, as we say. He's a doer. He's a revolutionary. He's a mover and shaker in the Continental Congress. Jefferson, on the other hand, he's written some extremely eloquent things already. He's wrote the Virginia's instructions to the Continental Congress. He's written essays. He's written a number of things that have shown he's an eloquent writer. Beyond that, he's not quite as well known yet. He's not yet become, obviously, governor of Virginia, president, other great things he gets involved in. He's not yet gone over and done mm-hmm. his work as ambassador to France. He's a good writer. He's younger, a little bit younger than Adams. He's the youngest, I believe, of that whole committee. And so they wanted to give it to the young guy who's a great writer who they could rely on to bat this out in pretty quick order. If you recall, the motion is in June. The declaration is written somewhat quickly over the course of the next several weeks. It's debated. One of the things that is important to look at in our history, if you want to try to understand these things, is the debate over the declaration in the Continental Congress. They famously strike some things in it, including a reference to a condemnation of the slave trade, mm-hmm. which Jefferson wanted in there, but certain southern colonies wouldn't allow it. They also add some references to God, which is actually very significant, because the Declaration has several important references to God in it. So that debate is important. So this is all going on, so that backs us up a little bit more. And the Declaration is actually passed, not on July 4th, but on July 2nd. And then it's signed on July 4th. So really, when you think about it and put this together, and I don't know how many words the declaration is, but it's writing shorter is harder to write.
Yeah.
It's a pretty impressive accomplishment, given that we didn't have, photocopiers and computers and clip and pastes.
Right.
And, it was a great accomplishment.
Dr. Spaulding, we'll pause right there and return in a moment, talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C., about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. More in a moment. Remember, you can sign up to get an email every time there's a new episode of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu. and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. You also can find older episodes of the program there, too. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To get an email every time there's a new episode of the program, go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. about the writing of the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson's involvement in it. Dr. Spaulding, what do we know about how Jefferson approached this task? How did he see his role, and where did he draw influence? Where did he take instruction from? How did he do it?
Well, part of it, and another thing, important thing to recall here is the extent to which the American founders, this was a really this unique generation of individuals who were extremely well read, who had not only read a lot of ideas of political thought and political philosophy, they knew their British history very well. They read each other, and this had been going on for at least a decade and a half. So they're intentionally involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it was he's working off of that intensity of the conversation. He has before him, and he makes references in his own letters to writers. In one letter, he famously talks about Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, and Sidney, which is a reference to John Locke. Mm-hmm. Algernon Sidney, they were both two great writers of the Glorious Revolution. Cicero, the great Roman. Aristotle, the great classic, the great Greek. He talks about Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc. But he refers to the great Republican writers. They understood these as great Republican. So they clearly have imbibed all of this. Jefferson is very familiar with all of these writings. He's read the pamphlets. He's read John Adams. He's read James Wilson, who's a great legal thinker of the time. So he's got this great amount of knowledge in his head that he's working with, and he says he's not trying to invent something new.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to give reflect the common mind, right, the sentiment of the time in doing this, and he tries to condense that down, and I think it's fair to say that based on everything I've studied, my teachers have studied, just reading, I mean, it is an amazing condensation, especially that second paragraph that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," of the whole political theory of the American founding. It's quite impressive.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us talking about the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson's writing of the Declaration. Congress eventually approves. There are debates. There are things taken out, as you alluded to earlier. But in your mind, what makes the Declaration a Jeffersonian document? Do we see his specific fingerprints in places in the Declaration?
Let me answer it this way. I think in some ways we do see his fingerprints, turns of phrases. I want to give Jefferson a great amount of credit by saying this. When I alluded to earlier that he writes a famous letter to Henry Lee, in which he says the object of the Declaration of Independence was not to find new principles or new arguments never before thought of, not merely to say things which have never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent. I think that we do see Jefferson's fingerprints on it, but I think it's misleading to say it's just Jefferson's fingerprints. We see the fingerprints of that whole generation of thinkers, of this founding generation, with its roots back to those great thinkers before them. And in that sense, it is not only a beautiful written work in and of itself, and Thomas Jefferson gets credit for the words, but it is a beautiful condensation of what the founders themselves thought, the common mind.
Mm-hmm.
of the time. And I think he should also be given credit for that. Too often, sometimes we in the debates about the Declaration and the broader debate about America, we might conclude that, Jefferson wrote it, Jefferson read Locke, therefore it's Locke. Well, there's some Lockean influence there. There's some important Lockean influences there, but there are some other influences there as well. And so I think it's very important to really kind of understand it in this broader broader context.
You mentioned that Jefferson included a charge initially that the king had waged cruel war against human nature by introducing slavery and allowing slave trade into the American colonies. Congress debated, removed it. What did that debate look like? Was it ever particularly close to remaining in the final document?
It got to the Continental Congress, and they debated it, and they had a vote, and it was important. This is, you know, kind of one of those great what-if questions, but also a great prudential question. You're about to declare independence, which means war, against the strongest nation in the world. You need unanimity. South Carolina and I think Georgia, if I'm remembering correctly, objected to a condemnation of the slave trade. Jefferson objected to them taking that out. But the Congress ultimately said, no, we've got to remove that. What they didn't remove, and what is clear from the debate, they did not remove a general statement that all men are created equal and endowed with inalienable rights. From the context of that debate and from the context of what others, great thinkers later, like Lincoln or Martin Luther King, right, that was the dagger, if you will, at the heart of slavery. So as much as we might recognize that, well, they did, there's this condemnation of slave trade, it was taken out. What does that mean? Well, I would have put it stayed in there. Jefferson wanted it to stay in there. The Constitution postponed the time at which we could abolish the slave trade. It turned out that he was president when the Constitution allowed the abolition of the slave trade, and Congress immediately abolished the slave trade, and he signed legislation with full federal authority to abolish slavery. So they got around to it.
Yeah.
But the more important thing that was in there was this statement that all men are created equal. Indeed, to come back to our general question, why is the Declaration of Independence important? Well, it's important because it declares independence as a practical matter. It begins this train of events. But the most important thing is it declares that principle which really drives American history. Lincoln later famously writes a great letter, which I can't quote in particular, so don't hold me to it. Where he says, "All honor to Jefferson, the man who in a mere revolutionary document had the foresight to put there an abstract principle applicable to all men in all times." That's why the Declaration is different. And that, in turn, is why American history is different.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C., talking about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great to be with you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with New York Times bestselling author James Rickards, recently on Hillsdale's campus, to discuss the cashless society. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Explore your world right from home with Turtle Bay TV.
Daintree is a jungle carpet python.
Featuring free educational and distance learning content for a virtual experience the whole family will enjoy.
Welcome to the vault.
Start streaming now at turtlebay.org.
Celebrate with us all month long at Wind River Resort and Casino and play our $100,000 Wild Cherry Zoom Ball Swipe to win. Win big cash prizes or $100,000. Plus, earn entries all month long to increase your chances to be a contestant Thursday at 7 p.m. Cheer for the colored balls to fill the Zoom Zone and walk away a winner. But wait, there's more. All contestants will have a second opportunity to win a new Wild Cherry Dodge Challenger. See WindRiver.com for official rules and find your moment with us at Wind River Resort and Casino.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Reading with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right, even cooking sometimes.
People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up, fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had got the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Are you new to crypto? It can leave you feeling unsure of what to do. Help is available. From getting started to securing your cryptos, you don't need to go it alone. Bitcoin 530 will take you by the hand to help you move forward with your crypto journey. Schedule a free consultation with Bitcoin 530 at bitcoin530.io or give them a call at 530-324-5175. That's bitcoin530.io.
Shasta County, are you ready for something real special? Mary's Pizza Shack has some changes. We're now Charlie's Tap House, and a tap house rule number one is come in for the homemade pizzas, pastas, and other house-made specialties, and stay for the beer wall.
Mary's Pizza Shack is now Charlie's Tap House, pizza, pasta, grill. Same family owners and same homemade recipes, plus a few more you'll want to try for yourself. Friday nights, try our special hand-cut prime rib for just $28 with all the fixings. And all week, you can enjoy surf and turf or salmon and polenta.
Don't miss Shasta County's premier tap beer wall with your favorite beers on demand that you can order by the ounce. Try our new house beer collaboration with Woody's Brewing, Flippin' Hazy. Your taste buds will thank you. And when you sign up for our Tap House Rewards program, you'll automatically get $5 off towards your next order. Remember, our vibe is casual. The atmosphere is social.
Order online at charlews.com. That's charlews.com.
There's more to explore with a Turtle Bay membership. Get unlimited access to world-class exhibits, exciting animal shows, towering playgrounds, and beyond. Family memberships are only $90 a year. That's less than $8 a month for a whole year of fun. Join today at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by James Rickards, author of six books about money and finance. His most recent book is The New Great Depression. You can find out more at his website, jamesrickardsproject.com. He is on Hillsdale's campus as we speak for one of our CCA lecture series. This one's on The Great Reset, and his topic is cashless society. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
This is such an interesting topic, and there's so many different angles. When we talk about a cashless society, do you think of that as being debit credit cards? Where do we see cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and that play in?
What's your definition, essentially, of a cashless society?
Well, that's a great question and a great place to start, because what's cash? Most people say, well, you know, I get some $20 bills in my pocket, or the Federal Reserve actually has a line item on their balance sheet called cash and coin in circulation, so they're counting quarters and dimes. In Philadelphia, we call it walking around money, but that's, you know, it's a common sense definition of cash. But if you look at the balance sheet of Apple or any corporation for that matter, on the asset side, the first line item is cash. And then you read the footnote, it says cash and equivalents. Well, what's that? Well, it includes bank deposits and highly liquid instruments, so maybe treasury bills, U.S. treasury bills, not treasury notes, et cetera, mm-hmm. and perhaps money market funds. You're like, well, okay, the accountants are saying cash can be things in a bank or basically you know, financial instruments of some kind. I always remind people that bank deposits, people go, well, my money's in the bank. I say, well, it's not your money. It's the bank's money. It's a bank deposit is an unsecured IOU from an occasionally insolvent financial institution. So what's cash is the first part of it. But yeah, we've come a long way to a cashless society. We're not all the way there yet. We take things for granted. You know, credit cards, debit cards, yeah, but PayPal, Venmo, Apple Pay, probably your paycheck, not everyone, but your paycheck probably is wired directly to your bank account mm-hmm. with an ACH transfer. I remember my first job, they actually gave us pay envelopes with money stuffed inside. Yeah. I was like, you know, I think I made 80 bucks a week or something like that. There'd be like four $20 bills in there. But so we're very far along. You know, there's an old saying, we don't know who discovered water, but we're pretty sure it was not a fish. And the point being, a fish doesn't know what water is because the fish is immersed in the water. And you have to take the fish out of the water, and the fish goes, where's the water? Mm-hmm. Then they realize what it is. And we're in a digital electronic society, have been for 130 years, probably or longer, starting with the more like 180 years, starting with the telegraph. But we're so far along now, we take it all for granted, and we don't realize that cash is going away without any, you know, draconian orders.
How does the concept of money as a symbol of value change in a cashless society?
So the simplest definition of money is if I have confidence that you'll accept it from me in exchange for goods and services, and furthermore, you have confidence that you can give it to somebody else in exchange for their goods and services, that's money. Mm-hmm. So anything, you know, people say, well, the dollar's not backed by anything, or Bitcoin's not backed by anything. Well, for that matter, gold's not backed by anything. It's gold. It's atomic number 79. It's a nice, it's pretty metal. But there's nothing behind the element. But what I point out is that all forms of money are backed by the same thing, which is confidence. People have confidence, it can be money. If they don't, it's not. But what policymakers take for granted, and this is a huge blunder, is confidence is very fragile. It can be very easily lost, and it's very difficult to regain. And so one of my concerns is that our central bankers, for that matter, the Congress, are taking the dollar for granted. They're like, well, it's always going to be money, and so we can print as much as we want, we can spend as much as we want, have deficits as big as we want, trade deficits as big as we want. And, yeah, there may be some policy implications behind it and choices, but it's always going to be money. And that is not true. So money is based on confidence. You know, the classic definition is store value, unit of account, medium of exchange. Store value can really be any asset class. You know, real estate is not money, but it is a store value. Mm-hmm. The question is, can you be all three? And that's a difficult question.
Talking with James Rickards about a cashless society here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Have we appropriately considered the consequences of going toward a cashless society? It's not happening overnight, as you mentioned earlier, but are we thinking enough about what this means for us?
No. And again, we're the fish in water. It just seems to kind of be happening. But some of the consequences are fairly troubling. One thing the global elites, and they want negative interest rates. And the solution to that is, okay, I put $100,000 in the bank and the interest rate is -1%. So I go away for a year and I come back and I have $99,000. You didn't give me $1,000 of interest. You took $1,000 of interest. People say, well, there's a simple answer for that. I'll just take my money out of the bank and, you know, stick it in a tin can buried in the backyard or whatever. But at least when I come back a year later, I'll still have $100,000 and you won't. digital money, elimination of cash is the pen. It's how you get people into the slaughterhouse of negative interest rates. So you have to eliminate cash so you have that option. But it goes beyond that. So, what if, they want to seize your account or freeze your account? Well, there are ways to do that, but it's a lot easier if all your money's in the account and they know exactly where it is. But think about it. Every point of purchase, you're under surveillance. It's all digital message traffic. It's not maybe encrypted by them, but not by you. So they know what you're buying. They know where you are, et cetera. I've worked on, projects, for the government where, you know, the question was, could you track terrorists using credit cards, for example? It's not easy, but the answer is, short answer is yes. But this is even more hands-on. Okay, so now you're under surveillance. They already have facial recognition software, and people go, well, I'll wear a mask, you know, with COVID. I'll wear a mask and a pair of sunglasses and a ski hat. Yeah, they have GAIT, G-A-I-T, recognition software, where everyone walks differently. Your walk is, yours or mine or anyone, is as distinctive as a set of fingerprints. So good luck with the mask. They're watching your hips. But now it's even better. So, okay, let's just take that a step further. And we got people like, you know, Merrick Garland running around putting, you know, people who attend school board meetings under FBI investigation. What if you buy the wrong book? What if you donate to the wrong candidate? What if you, affiliate with some organization that may be exercising free speech, but that the Department of Justice thinks it's your domestic terrorist, et cetera? Now they know. And they can put you on a watch list. They can assign an FBI officer, you know, agent to keep an eye on you, et cetera. And you wouldn't know it. And then you combine that with things like the Patriot Act, which has kind of soft workarounds of the Fourth Amendment. And everyone at the time was like, yeah, well, it's a good thing. We've got to get rid of these terrorists. Yeah, and it worked. But Rand Paul was one of the few, Senator Paul was one of the few who said at the time, not now with hindsight, but at the time, no, we're going down the wrong path here, and this is going to erode civil rights. And so you combine the shortcuts in the Patriot Act with this kind of total surveillance of every point of purchase, every online transaction, et cetera, and then a political motivation. It's hard. You get to a point pretty quickly where it's hard to see the difference between communist China and the United States.
And just to tie this together with the theme of the lecture series, The Great Reset, you talked a little earlier about how this might benefit some of the elites, the global elites. Is a cashless society, because people can go and see The Great Reset and what the plans are.
Sure.
Is it actually in those plans? Is this a stated goal of The Great Reset?
It absolutely is. And again, I'll point to Ken Rogoff's book, The Curse of Cash. But the short answer is, yeah, if you read Klaus Schwab's book, I think his book is called The Great Reset, which is the title of our colloquium here. And again, Ken Rogoff's book, and Janet Yellen's recent statements. She's our Secretary of the Treasury in support of Biden administration plans to have complete readouts of every bank account in the country. And they're debating $600 or $10,000. Right. Well, I'm sorry, if you could be selling t-shirts. You're making more than $10,000. So they say it. Yeah, they're very explicit about it. And then you have to say why. And I think the reasons are the ones I mentioned, which are surveillance. And then sometimes people say, well, yeah, I'm okay with surveillance as long as they're only surveilling the bad guys. So what happens if you're the bad guy, according to them? That's the problem.
James Rickards, you can find his most recent book, The New Great Depression, and more at the website, jamesrickardsproject.com. Speaking here at Hillsdale College on cashless society. James, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, Stephen Smith from Hillsdale's English Department tells us more about Sir Thomas More. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Slow down. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world: family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Traveling Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. Time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR 1460 a.m. or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe, or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Dr. Stephen Smith, Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Smith, also the co-editor of a book released last year, The Essential Works of Thomas More, which we discuss
here today. In a nutshell, for people who perhaps don't have a great knowledge, who was Thomas More?
He was the great Renaissance Englishman who published the Utopia, among many other writings, and who also served as a statesman for King Henry VIII. His life is very famously, especially the end of it, dramatized in Man for All Seasons, his conflict with Henry, and his death on Tower Hill. It also is the subject of a play on which Shakespeare collaborated. And so, in his life and in his death, one of the most famous English historical characters, he was also well regarded during his lifetime for his friendship, and also for his family, which was famous across Europe.
Now, this book, The Essential Works of Thomas More, why, tell us a little bit about it, first of all, and then why was it necessary? Why was it something that needed to be done?
Well, sometimes we take for granted the tools we have. A collected edition of Shakespeare's plays, a collected edition of Milton's poetry, the books we need to seriously study a first-rate major author. For Thomas More, there are translations and editions of Utopia available aplenty, but his other works, not so much so. So our goal was to collect in one volume the best of his English and Latin writings in prose and poetry and present them to the contemporary world. So it's a large book. It is a one-stop shop, if you will, for Thomas More. And it has a great supporting website as well, www.essentialmore.org.
People largely know about Thomas More's Utopia, which you referenced. We actually talked about it previously on the program with Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. And this is essential, though. So what are some of the other, perhaps lesser-known works that have been collected in this volume?
So Utopia, as you say, is his most famous book, but the riches of his authorship are pretty extraordinary. He has a life of the Renaissance intellectual, Pico. He has English and Latin poetry. He's written dialogues on theology. He's written a history of King Richard III, which became one of the major sources for William Shakespeare's breakthrough tragedy. In addition to all of these works, he left a long written legacy in letters. Letters to family and friends, letters to figures like Erasmus, a remarkable set of writings contained in the essential works.
Now, his theological works, what prompted More to go down that path, to begin writing about theological matters?
Well, More wrote about theological matters from beginning to end. His early poetry addresses the subject of death and the love of God, for example. That Life of Pico that I mentioned has as one of its central themes the love of God and theology. So the theology and the theological interest is present from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later in his life, especially as things heated up in Europe with the Reformation, he entered into the fray, first assisting Henry in his response to Luther, and then writing, for example, the 1529 dialogue in which he addresses most of the Reformation controversies, including the relationship between faith and love, human freedom, the nature of the church, and so on. At the end of his life, when he was imprisoned in the Tower of London, he also wrote on theology, but here, with his own, you know, trial and looming death, I think, more in mind, he wrote a treatise on the Passion, for example, a treatise on the Blessed Body, his great work, A Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation, which C.S. Lewis thought should be on every man's shelf, and then finally, his last sort of broken off a work, The Sadness of Christ, a work in Latin that is a commentary on the Garden of Gethsemane.
Talking with Dr. Stephen Smith, his book, The Essential Works of Thomas More, he is co-editor on that. What about his historical writings? What might be distinctive about his historical writings, and do we still see some of that theological bend, his faith, his philosophy, and those historical works as well?
Well, his History of Richard III is a fabulous piece of writing. It exists in two forms, English and Latin. I just love the English version to death. I'll confess freely, I'm a Shakespeare nut, so there's a reason for that.
Well known around campus.
But Moore's English is wonderful, and that work in particular, among my favorites. In it, you know, in that historical work, he takes up themes that preoccupy him across his whole lifetime. For example, the problem of tyranny, how tyranny happens in a country, how it is resisted or not resisted, why a tyrant succeeds, things like that. He also looks at a theme like human blindness and why the principal political actors in the history seem to suffer from this affliction in particular. And then also a great theme like law itself, mm-hmm. the nature of law, the way a tyrant might use law to perpetrate his tyranny. Moore was a great lawyer and a judge himself. In fact, he was voted, I think in 1999, the Lawyer of the Millennium in Great Britain. So he had an interest in this subject as well. But that work in particular I recommend to listeners. I think it's just fascinating. It's also funny. It's witty. And that humor illuminates a very dark story in ways that remind me of Shakespeare as well.
How would you describe the influence that Moore's writing had upon those writers who would come?
Well, The Utopia is one of the great books of the Western world, and its publication, you know, launches an entire modern genre of utopian and dystopian fiction. Of course, that genre has its roots back in antiquity and everything. But it's been described as, you know, a book that launched 1,000 books up to our own day. So that is a very influential piece of writing. The other way to look at Moore, of course, involves his life, which has never ceased to fascinate readers, citizens, other authors. Of course, there's Man for All Seasons in the 20th century, but a lot of folks don't know that Shakespeare collaborated on a play version of Moore's life called Sir Thomas More, a play that was never produced, but which survives, and which we include in the appendix to the Essential Works. It's the only example that we have of a piece of literary writing in Shakespeare's own hand. We actually have the manuscript. So that play is mysterious, very interesting, and it's an example of a later group of writers responding to his life, and especially his death, and telling their version of it.
Dr. Stephen Smith, again, the website that goes along with the book is essentialmore.org.
Right, and there's also another website, Thomas More Studies. .org, which is related as well, the Center for Thomas More Studies website.
So if you can't get enough from the essential works of Thomas More, there's always more, no pun intended, online. Dr. Stephen Smith is the co-editor of the Essential Works of Thomas More, also Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Matt Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. talking about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration, James Rickards here on Hillsdale's campus on the Cashless Society, and Stephen Smith on Sir Thomas More. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You can also find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, and now iHeart. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu.
The assistant producer of the show is Nate Espenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Explore your world right from home with Turtle Bay TV.
Daintree is a jungle carpet python.
Featuring free educational and distance learning content for a virtual experience the whole family will enjoy.
Welcome to the vault.
Start streaming now at turtlebay.org.
Hey guys, Dave Ramsey here. Join me and the Ramsey personalities as we give you the tools and motivation you need to win in the areas of money, career, and more. Right here on The Ramsey Show. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 AM in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on the Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance is now open at 3673 Eureka Way. Physical therapists Kevin Elo and Rachel Lang have a combined 29 years of experience in helping those who've suffered orthopedic injuries, strains, and sprains. Kevin has worked with the USA Gymnastics team, NFL Combine, and professional BMX riders. He's also helped members of Cirque du Soleil get back into action. Rachel works closely with seniors and is also a group fitness instructor and adept at returning people to an active lifestyle. Both Kevin and Rachel at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance are accepting new clients. Give them a call today, 530-533-5030. If you are in need of physical therapy, talk to the experts at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance at 3673 Eureka Way. Call 530-533-5030. That's 530-533-5030 today.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Hey friends, this is RC with Tobacco and Brew. Today we're talking about the Fugly from Tabacalera El Artista. Coming in a 5x40 Vitola, the Fugly is priced just right for our value-conscious customers. Draped in a chocolatey brown San Andres leaf, presented in natural or Maduro, this stick is a throwback to a Cheroot vintage. The Fugly from Tabacalera El Artista, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. And there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that. And it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet. Mount Shasta spring water.
The YMCA is welcoming new members to come and enjoy the many choices the YMCA has to offer. The YMCA has a variety of fitness activities, including swimming, aqua aerobics, cardio, weights, group power classes, and booty yoga. There's over 100 classes to choose from. The YMCA is so much more than a gym. The Y is a community. Join the YMCA. 246-YMCA. Or go online to sfymca.org.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
It's the Ramsey Show, talk radio, where debt is dumb and cash is king. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR, Shasta Reading, by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.